Good morning. My name is Ryan Meyer, and I am a fairly new member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Manhattan. Whether this is your first time here at our fellowship, or your 10th, or your 100th, I would just like to say we welcome you here with an open mind and a warm heart, and we hope you enjoy the service. As Unitarian Universalists, we believe in an individual's pursuit of truth through understanding and compassion. We profess no particular creed here at our fellowship. Whatever your religious background, your sexual orientation, your political persuasion, your gender identification, your sex, your race, etc., you are welcome here. Whatever path does bring you here, we invite you to settle into our space and join us in our continued pursuit of the truth in all things. Before we begin our service, I'd just like to draw your attention to the announcements in your bulletin. Make sure you look at those and see if there's anything you'd like to get involved in or anything that you'd be interested in. Also, I'd just like to mention the Saving Our Social Services Organizing Committee is signing a petition to try to convince the city to not cut spending on social services. So I just wanted to let you all know that you can go ahead and sign that petition after the service. And with that, I invite you to stand as you are able and sing as you are moved the opening hymn, number 163. At this time, I'd like to invite all the children up for the children's conversation with Katie Meyer.
Good morning, everybody. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm Katie Meyer, I'm Ryan's wife. And if you see Kieran and Luke running around, those are my little boys. And there's another one. Destiny wants me to tell you there's another one coming. It's a boy, a third boy. I think we're finished. Okay. We're going to read a story today. It's called While You Are Away, and it's a story about when people's parents or caregivers or grandparents are away for work and things like that. Especially today we're talking about soldiers, so that's who they talk about in this book, okay? While you are on that big ship, Daddy, far, far away, I miss you. I miss going to the farmer's market on Saturday mornings. I miss baking brownies, hunting for salamanders, collecting river rocks. While you are on that big ship, Daddy, far, far away, I wonder about you. I wonder, what is my daddy eating for breakfast? I wonder, who is bringing chicken soup to my daddy when he has a cold? I wonder, where is my daddy sleeping? Is he cozy and warm? While you are on that big ship, Daddy, far, far away, I pack things to mail to you. Peanut butter fudge, my school picture, the potholder I made all by myself. Maybe they can use it in the ship's kitchen. While you are on that big ship, Daddy, far, far away, I tell you things. I pretend the wind can carry my words clear across the ocean right to your heart. I tell you how sometimes I'm scared of the dark. I tell you how much I love you. I tell you how much I wish you were here when you are far, far away. While you are flying that fast plane, Mommy, far, far away, I think about you. I look up into the big blue sky and think my happiest thoughts so you can fly through them as if they are clouds and smile and think of me too. While you are flying that fast plane, Mommy, far, far away, I wrap myself up in your old green sweater. It feels fuzzy and warm. I play your silver music box and dance with your pillow. And when it's bedtime and the sky is all starry, I blow kisses to the moon. Can you catch those kisses, Mommy, from so far, far away? I think so. While you are flying that fast plane, Mommy, far, far away, I dream about you coming home. In my dream, I'm carrying a red balloon so you can spot me in the crowd. In my dream, you bring me a little bag of presents, but the very best present of all is you. What are you dreaming about, Mommy, far, far away? While you are driving that speedy Jeep, Papa, far, far away, I talk about you. I bring your photograph to show and tell. I read the letters you send to me out loud to my pet hamster. I sing your favorite song to my best friend Max. So what if Max covers his ears? While you are driving that speedy Jeep, Papa, far, far away, I want you to know that I am taking good care of your garden. I pull the weeds, I water the cilantro, I paint the fence around the roses, I chase the rabbits. Shoo, I say, this is my papa's garden. While you are driving that speedy Jeep, Papa, far, far away, I remember what you told me. Wear your seatbelt, do your homework, give Mama extra hugs, don't let the bed bugs bite. Do you remember what I told you, Papa? Keep safe, stay well, don't get lost driving that speedy Jeep far, far away. While you are driving that speedy Jeep, Papa, far, far away, I wait for the morning Mama will make me wake me up and say, this is the day to turn cartwheels across the living room, the day to laugh until my tummy aches, the day to cry a cereal full bowl of happy tears, The day to meet you at the station, Papa, home at last from far, far away. And then look at this picture. Everybody's parents are there. You guys see that? Okay, so now we're going to go back to our classrooms. Everybody.
We will now receive the gift of your offering. Distant Thunder. This is a personal reflection written by Sergeant Dennis Pryor during his time in Iraq during the buildup to the first Gulf War. His reflection was published in Operation Homecoming, which was a project funded by the National Endowment of the Arts, which provided soldiers with professional authors and teachers and workshops in order to help them develop into better writers so they could write about their wartime experience. Distant Thunder. I hate the idea of war, and yet I can't wait for it to begin. Every soldier in Kuwait feels the same way, even though we don't say so. Never, in fact, talk about it. Every day as we inch closer to the inevitable but still unknown date when we'll charge over that berm, we grow more and more certain that it is a terrible idea. And grow more anxious for it to start. Partly because we want to set out before the horrifying heat of the summer starts to simmer, partly because we just want to get it over with, but mostly, deep down, we are afraid it might not ever happen. And even though we don't want it to happen, we've grown to count on it. We are, however reluctant, soldiers, and we have trained and trained and lived and eaten and slept 100 pretend wars. And we are desperately ready to commence with the real one, however much we dread it. At this point, we're going to show a small video clip from the documentary Restrepo. It does contain some strong language and some violent images, so if you feel like this is something you don't want to see or you don't want your children to see, if there are any here, we'll ask you to step out at this time.
Well, how do you top that? I don't know. It's going to be an interesting task, won't it? Well, first of all, I want to say good morning. Good morning. It's a real, real, real joy for me to be here. This is not my first visit to Kansas. I used to drill down the road at Topeka for a number of years when I was working with a combat stress unit for the Army Reserve. So it was really nice to see these lovely hills again with all of the terrain and all of the perspective and all of the beautiful trees. I want to thank Ryan and Katie. I really want to thank Ryan a lot for discovering me on the internet. I don't know if he told you about that, but that's how we came to know each other over the last couple of months. And preparing to put this service together. I really want to thank Steve and Marilyn a whole lot also for their wonderful, wonderful hospitality. I've had a great time being here this weekend. For those of you who missed the training that I did yesterday on spirituality and combat trauma and also on post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury, do not lose heart. We taped the whole thing. And it will be, I'm told, it will be posted on the website. So we will be on the internet. So you will be able to download it as a podcast if you want. And finally, I want to say I hope that things will continue to go well here in Kansas, particularly with the situation of social services. As a good chaplain and as a good clinical social worker, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that I've been informed by some of you all here that your domain has been referred to at times as Brownbeckistan. So I'm going to hope and pray that things get all the more better here in Brownbeckistan for now and for the foreseeable future. And you're probably wondering, what do we have in store when we've got this guy from Texas, of all things, who's going to be preaching you a sermon of all things about what comes after beer, pizza, and sex. So, well, anyway, you will soon find out. But prior to us getting there, let me just say a few words. I am a United Church of Christ clergy person. However, I've spent a heck of a lot more time doing work with the Unitarian Universalist Association. I've been doing work with the UUA now for various congregations, fellowships, etc., in Texas and elsewhere for, well over the past going on 13, 14 years. I'm also a clinical social worker and marriage and family therapist, currently working for the Department of Veterans Affairs in San Antonio. And I also am an Army reservist in the Medical Service Corps as a lieutenant colonel, and spent actually four and a half years serving on active duty in various capacities working as a mental health provider. I'm going to invite you to listen to two readings this morning. Actually three, but they're brief. One ancient and two more contemporary. So listen for these readings. First, we will hear the words from the Gospel of Matthew, reading from the 24th chapter and verse 7. Hear the words of the writer, whoever they may have been. And think about it in context of that moving excerpt that we witnessed from the brilliant film Restrepo and the wonderful music of John Baez. Nation will rise up against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and there will be earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginnings of birth pains. And a selection from, and if you're not familiar with this work, I would highly commend it to you, a selection from Chris Hedges, brilliant writer, founder of the website TruthDig, and a writer of numerous books like War and Its Presence of Meaning, and his book Losing Moses on the Freeway. I love that title. And here is a selection from Chris's book, Collateral Damage, America's War Against Iraqi Civilians. Listen for the words of Chris Hedges, who would have us to know. It's hard when you're going in as a soldier and you're being told by your command and your leaders that you're there to liberate those people and to bring them democracy, and then those people that you're supposed to be liberating are killing you, said Specialist Reppenhagen. You go out on missions and people launch RPGs at you, and when you see where they come from and you go to the house and you ask the people in the house, where's the guy on the roof that was shooting the RPG at us? And they're like, no, Ali Baba, no bad guy, you know, no boom booms explosions. So it just gets frustrating because you start to realize that you're not getting any help from the people around you, he said. They're just, you know, they might not be actively participating in the insurgency itself, but they're certainly not trying to help you get the guys that you're after. So there becomes a rift. And the soldiers start trusting the Iraqi people, and then they stop trusting the Iraqi people, and they start hating them. And you can generally get degraded to the point where if you kill somebody, you have to almost dehumanize your enemy. And that starts to spread into, you know, the Iraqi people. And instead of blaming your own command and putting you there in that situation, you start blaming the Iraqi people because you can't abuse your own chain of command and your superiors. But you do have complete power over the average Iraqi person. And a lot of times, it's too much power for like an 18-year-old kid straight out of high school put in a fearful war situation to be able to handle and compute, let alone materially process. So it's a constant psychological battle to try to keep, stay humane, and treat the Iraqi in a justifiable way. We had come into Iraq, said Specialist Steve Martello, most of us not with a clear thing, like we're going to attack these people, you know what I mean? We wanted to help people at first. When people just started dying left and right, you become cold. And it stops being about helping people. You start to just form this deep, deep hatred for the people you're fighting against. You become incapable of doing things. You become capable of doing things you could never have thought you could have done. And then when you come back, you have to live with that. And that sucks. May our reading be enhanced and edified by what we have heard today. All right, I know you've been waiting with bated breath. I would be too. You're wondering, what could the answer be to this long-held universal question? Yes, I'm talking about what does indeed come after beer, pizza, and sex? Well, here we go, all right? I have to tell you a story. As I said, I got recalled to active duty. Yeah, I got recalled to active duty in 2006 when I was 52. And it's not like I wouldn't have expected it. It was interesting timing when it occurred, let me say it that way. Because I thought, I'm 52, I'm getting more gray hair, I'm not in the most svelte figure like I would have been in my 30s. I thought, well, I guess they really do need me. I mean, granted, the Army and, military needs as many mental health people as they get. And I thought, well, they know that I was a chaplain before, too. But I thought, do they really know what they're getting with this package? Do they really know? Because I'm probably going to be the colonel that their mother warned them about, So anyway, to start things off, right before I left, before this long, strange trip it's been, remember the Grateful Dead? Right before I left for this deployment in April 2006, I'm attending this conference on the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder at my very own Audie L. Murphy Division of the South Texas Veterans Healthcare System, what a mouthful that is, in San Antonio, Texas. So this conference was being held for all of us mental health professionals, and there were a lot of very, very helpful presentations that gave information about then the latest, most effective treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, here was one of those Memorex E.F. Hutton moments, because one of the presentations was on one of my favorite areas, and that was on psychopharmacology. What do we need to know in order to get better and smarter about dosing medications that will help people recover as soon as they can? I thought, okay, I'm all ears. I want to increase my knowledge curve about all of this. And the presenter who was there is a really, really fine, nice guy by the name of Dr. Harold Cudler, really fine clinical psychologist, works at Duke Medical School and is part of the VISN for the VA Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina, and is the department head for psychiatry. So I remember as I'm listening to this great presentation, Dr. Cudler stated, as we all are, that clinicians are forever, forever trying to figure out what helps returning military personnel and veterans cope the best with the reality of combat trauma. And then he went on to say he particularly emphasized what medications and particularly what type of medication protocols best help and assist people in their healing. Now, at one point, Dr. Cudler shared that he had talked recently to a military commander, and he had mentioned to the military commander about this presentation and what he was doing. And the military commander mentioned as follows regarding what they were talking about was some important features about recovery for military personnel and veterans, how best to help people heal from post-traumatic stress disorder. And Dr. Cudler mentioned that in this conversation with the said military commander, the good colonel responds to Dr. Cudler the following sentence. And let me say it in my best colonel voice. The colonel said to Dr. Cudler, well, maybe what the need is some beer, pizza, and sex. Spoken like a true colonel, right? You and I have worked for them. You know? We know where they're at. Well, after Dr. Cudler's presentation, I was a brave soul, wasn't I? I raised my hand and I asked Dr. Cudler, Dr. Cudler, is there any longitudinal research arguing for the efficacy of beer, pizza, and sex as a frontline intervention for returning military veterans and personnel? Now, as you can imagine, there was a lot of laughter. Well, what can I tell you? 4.5 years working in the trenches in the continental U.S. on behalf of working with those coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and treating mental health, working in behavioral health. Well, I can tell you that during the 2.5 years that I was at Medical Task Force Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and I was running behavioral health, and I set up and I ran the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program, there were some opportunities, surely, to drink beer. There were certainly opportunities to eat pizza, but there were certainly no opportunities for sex. My wife was in San Antonio. I was in Camp Shelby. Now, one of my colleagues, a Yale-trained, wonderfully talented, taught at Yale clinical psychologist who is of Chinese-American descent and is a good friend of mine, observed when I told her I was doing this sermon. She said, and I quote, well, Peter, you've got the frontal lobe of the brain covered with that title. And so I pose the question today. So what do returning military personnel who are faced with the reality of war, of witnessing suffering and death, and killing of those who are culpable of violence, and of those who are innocent, what do they need to be able to recover in body and in mind and in spirit? Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the biopsychosocial spiritual person. What do they need? What do I need in order to be able to make meaning of the experience of war and the meaning of self-identity? Making that transition from warrior to citizen and back to warrior and back to citizen and back to warrior and back to citizen and to quote-unquote on some eventual continuum to becoming a participating member of the society. Because it's no longer, as I say, It's no longer just one deployment. I mean, we left that ages ago. It's more like 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in absurdum. And unfortunately, little bit of time or ridiculous amount of time of recovery in between, sometimes as little as 3 months. So this is a huge question and challenge, isn't it? For every day, there are countless numbers of men and women returning from war who don't know how to make this transition. I see them every day in my office in San Antonio. They can feel thwarted, and they can feel stuck in what I would describe as this badlands of knowing death and not being able to experience again the gift or the life of beauty. This becomes a core issue of identity. And some of the questions that get raised are as follows. What type of person was I before the war? What type of person am I now? Am I scared to death of myself now? What type of person will I become in the future? And what can, quote unquote, a post-war future look like for me? What are the obligations of the nation and of the citizens in supporting and taking care of those who have fought in war and who now need healing? Those are huge questions. And unfortunately, most of the time, we're not discussing them, I don't think, nearly as readily and as thoroughly as we should. We get sucked up in so much propaganda about, oh, isn't it great what the troops are doing? Or isn't it wonderful? Or we get sucked up with, let's have yellow stickers on the back of our vehicles while other people and other political leaders, shall we say, have told us to shop or go to Aruba. And then lost in all of this are these fundamental questions that I think that need to be discussed and need to be debated and need to be thoroughly, thoroughly examined. That's if we're going to be an enlightened society, which I hope and pray we all want to be committed to be doing. What I think warriors need is meaning for the experience of fighting, and more so, meaning for the experience of dealing with the aftermath of fighting. But I also believe, and here's the answer to the question, I also believe that warriors need the experience of transcendence. Yes, another T word. The experience of transcendence. Some experience that allows them to move beyond the persona of killing and to be able to affirm life in all of its fullest sense, including pursuing peace, and most importantly, pursuing personal peace. It's been said that people in combat do not fight for patriotism, as Jones sang this morning, I don't fight for freedom. And they don't fight for necessarily honor and glory either, but rather they fight to keep that woman or man next to them who is serving with them alive. They fight for each other, and they fight for everything that this human bond signifies. So transcendence, getting back to the T word again, transcendence fundamentally deals with that which is beyond the human finite experience. Think about it. That's what the transcendentalists, right, were all about. That's what Emerson, Margaret Fuller, Ralph Thoreau, all of those wonderful forebearers of ours, right, as Unitarian Universalists, that's what they were about. It deals with the realm of ethics and of religion. Now, our friend Chris Hedges in his book, I Don't Believe in Atheists, states that all ethics begins with religion, And he goes on to write and he says, we must determine what moral laws to accept and reject. We must distinguish between the false and the real prophets. And then Chris Hedges goes on when he argues and he says, religion is not based upon, quote unquote, authority, magic, and, dare I say, taboo. Rather, religion for him is based upon the ethics of personal responsibility and the freedom of conscience. Personal responsibility and the freedom of conscience. That sounds pretty Unitarian Universalist to me. Where rigid formal obedience to law allows the adherent to avoid ethical choice, the truly moral life grapples with the inscrutable call to do what is right, to reach out to those who are reviled, those who are labeled outcasts or enemies, and to practice compassion and tolerance, even at the cost of self-annihilation. Recently, and some of you this weekend have heard this story, recently, a chaplain friend of mine, who's in the United Church of Christ as well, was presented with the following ethical dilemma. Don't you love it when we have to deal with those? He was about to attend, and you Army folks will appreciate this, he was about to attend what's called a targeting meeting. A targeting meeting. Now, for those of you who don't know what a targeting meeting is, that's where you get a bunch of military folks around a table, usually your S1 or your S2, your S3. You have your executive officer, you have your commander. And depending upon the unit, you may have the chaplain involved if they so choose. But the whole purpose of the targeting meeting is that you're around this table and you do this table exercise and you make decisions about what sites, i.e. objects, in this case houses, that you're going to attack versus those buildings that you will have be spared, all right? So my friend clearly stated to the commanding officer, and he said that he clearly would not be able to attend the said targeting meeting because it would go against the grain of his religious convictions as a United Church of Christ clergy person, and that his role as a chaplain, and I liked how he framed this, his role as a chaplain would not be theologically embraced by his denomination if he was a party to this targeting meeting. Now, as the conversation progressed regarding this matter, command officials, of course, went on to argue that chaplains should attend non-lethal, I liked how they framed this, non-lethal targeting meetings. Non-lethal targeting meetings. It does raise the question for me, who would Jesus bomb? Can you see that bumper sticker now? I could. Keith Edwards, who's a friend of mine, who is the chaplain, national chaplain for the Department of Veterans Affairs, has argued that military personnel and veterans who experience combat trauma really face three fundamental questions regarding identity. And these questions are as follows. You know, every sermon has 3 points, right? Well, here they are. They're coming at you right now. And like Colbert and like, you know, our buddy John Stewart and our previous buddy David Letterman, here they are, all right? Point number one. And the question is, who am I? Who am I? The question that has to do with self-integration. And then the question number two is, what will I do? And that one is about self-creativity. And finally, the third question, which I think is the real important question when we look at the crux and the ethical dilemma of the situation we're talking about this morning. How will I decide? How will I decide? And that's all about self-transcendence. These questions become crucial in their importance as military personnel and veterans continue to recover years and years and years after the fact from combat trauma. Now, it's true, yes, that there have always been wars. I mean, the reality that we talk about now is post-traumatic stress disorder, and recorded history goes all the way back to the Peloponnesian War. It's been certainly recognized as other things throughout time. It's been referred to as soldier's heart during the Confederacy. It's been referred to shell shock in World War II. It's been referred to combat stress in World War II, and now post-traumatic stress disorder since 1980 and on. So yes, there's always been quote-unquote wars. The Gospel of Matthew speaks about nations rising up against nations and how there will be wars and rumors of wars. Now, of course, this particular language was very, very typical of Hellenistic Jewish apocalyptic thought of the first century Common Era. Indeed, in the writer's mind, this type of conflict was inevitable as much as the experience of birth pains. Now, some of you women out there may have avoided that one. If you have, bless you. The reaction of Jewish leaders, the reaction of religious leaders, and the use of force, including military force, is interesting as well. We see Jesus exercising what could be described as, yes, as a preemptive strike strategy. When he turns over the tables and he drives out those money changers from the temple. Isn't it interesting that we have not heard that story at all in the present conversation about the Occupy movement? What does that say about what the churches are doing and where their values are? Here, the use of force is designed to cleanse and purify, quote unquote, a holy place from defilement. Muhammad is described initially as being a merchant, and then what does he do? He goes through a transformation, and he becomes a preacher, and then he goes on and he becomes a warrior. Buddha is described as finally experiencing enlightenment by sitting down underneath the Bodhi tree. And then by so doing, he ends up achieving personal peace. The challenge of experiencing that sacred space, that still small voice in the words of the prophet Ezekiel, in war can become even more insurmountable. Chris Hedges describes this horrific scene in the book Collateral Damage, where an army unit was raiding a house that was allegedly harboring Iraqi insurgents. And I highlight allegedly harboring. And he writes and he documents, so what we ended up doing was using a translator, and we had these loudspeakers, and we rolled up on these houses, and it was 5 a.m, and we said, you've got 5 minutes to get dressed and to get outside. We have intelligence that says you might be housing an insurgent. Lo and behold, everybody obeyed, got dressed, got out of their house, waited outside. And we ended up going in looking for these weapons or these bad guys. But there weren't any weapons, and there weren't any bad guys. And we did it in a way that was much less offensive than the way we had done the raid a couple of days before. But the intelligence was completely wrong. These mistakes could have tragic consequences, Specialist Middleton, a medic of the 82nd Airborne, said to his army buddy, also a medic, who was loaned out to a special forces unit on a raid because he spoke Arabic. They wanted a guy they can trust as an interpreter, Middleton explained. They put like a sharp charge and the door was blown open, but there was a pregnant woman on the other side. And apparently it blew like the fetus out onto the ground and it killed her instantly. And he continued, and he's a medic, you know, as well as an interpreter, and he's crying, and it turned out to be the wrong house. Anyway, and basically they knocked on the door and they detonated it. So they kill the first person who answers the door. and then go through. And then these guys are, oh, like this is war. You've got to deal with it. Combat trauma, such as this, tends to produce a lot of survivor guilt for those who survive. Soldiers and others and family members who survive such experiences of carnage are likely to ask the question again and again and again, why did they die and not me? Some will resign themselves fatalistically to saying, well, it's your time to go, so this is your time. This, of course, raises the big question, and I got another T word for you, okay? This raises the whole question of theodicy. How does one respond to the excruciating real presence of evil in the world? All of this also begs the question, what kind of religious support can we provide those returning from war? There are so many soldiers, so many sailors, so many airmen, so many Marines, so many coasties, merchant Marines, you name it, who I see who don't feel that they deserve any sense of healing. They tell themselves, what I have done in combat is so bad that I can't tell anyone, because if I do, they will think that I am a monster, and in turn, I deserve to be killed. It's as if our old buddy Eric Clapton was right when he mournfully observed, I know that I don't belong here in heaven. Transcendence, that T word I'm talking about, transcendence, if it's going to be meaningful, has at some point on the continuum, it's got to involve forgiveness. Those who are engaged in combat and who have killed, and those who have experienced the aftermath of killing, need to be able to experience forgiveness for their actions, and for those who have experienced the devastation, they also need to experience forgiveness and healing as well. But we know it doesn't come overnight. Look at South Africa. We've seen examples like the Truth and Reconciliation Movement there, where perpetrators of killing and those who have been victimized by killing at some point finally were able to sit down at the table and they were able to meet together. The party that was offended was given the opportunity to give public testimony to their hurt and loss while the perpetrator listened. And after this, the opportunity occurs, if appropriate, for forgiveness and reconciliation to occur. There have been instances where this type of model has been used in the United States. As time goes on, it's going to be very interesting to see if this type of model would work in our country, particularly with military personnel who have suffered combat trauma. Recently, I saw a bumper sticker on a car that a friend of mine owns. And my friend is in this case, a retired Army clinical psychologist. And the bumper sticker on the back of his car read the following inscription. And it was, war is expensive, comma, peace is priceless. I would concur. There are those warriors and others who would argue for an immediate prefrontal lobe intervention right now. A holy trinity of beer, pizza, and sex. As an immediate frontal lobe prescription for the pain and torment and the unending angst of combat. There are even some religious leaders, whether they be Christian, whether they be Jewish, Muslim, etc., who would represent dare I say, a Johnny Jihad position where there is no theological and no moral conflict or struggle with war and its carnage and aftermath. We were talking about some of those Johnny Jihads earlier today with Marilyn and Steve. What comes after beer, pizza, and sex? Well, maybe, just maybe, there is transcendence. Just maybe there can be unity with self and with others. I am convinced that as we continue to send our best and bravest men and women to fight in war, that we need as a country and that we need as a society to face the hard questions of what this all means for the aftermath, for those who serve, and for all of us who need to support them. For all of us who need to support one another as well. May it be so for us now and forevermore. We pray. Shalom. Amen. Salam. Blessed be.
Just going to quickly leave you all with a short poem. This poem is entitled, When Someone Deeply Listens to You. When someone deeply listens to you, it's like holding out a dented cup you've had since childhood and watching it fill up with cold, fresh water. When it bounces on top of the brim, you are understood. When it overflows and touches your skin, you are loved. When someone deeply listens to you, the room where you stay starts a new life, and the place where you wrote your first poem begins to glow in the mind's eye, as if gold has been discovered. When someone deeply listens to you, your bare feet are on the earth, and the beloved lamb that seemed distant is now at home within you.